From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Those Mexican workers who crossed the border to get into California, that is to get into the territory that was taken from Mexico in the Mexican War, you see. And those Mexican workers who come over, and many of them die and are killed in the process, you see. Those people are not alien to me, you see. Those 20 million Americans who are not citizens, but who now, because of the Patriot Act, are subject to indefinite detention without any constitutional rights, those people are not alien to me. But those men in the White House who are making these decisions to send young people to kill and be killed, those people are alien to me.
On this Labor Day special, historian Howard Zinn and a special appearance by Mother Jones on the March of the Mill Children.
I stand before you today on behalf of the helpless children. Organized labor and humanity demand protection for these helpless victims of insatiable greed. I have seen your children murdered. Murdered. You are living in America. America, where Patrick Henry and Jefferson live, those heroes of days gone by. A day of child slavery has got to end.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! On this Labor Day, I'm Amy Goodman. Labor Day was established more than a century ago. It was a time of tremendous unrest in America. Grover Cleveland was president. Railroad workers, organized by Eugene V. Debs, were leading a nationwide strike against George Pullman. Pressured by railroad executives, President Grover Cleveland declared the strike a federal crime and called out 12,000 troops. U.S. deputy marshals fired on protesters near Chicago. The strike was over. Debs went to prison. And Cleveland tried to win the labor vote in his reelection by signing off on a congressional bill establishing Labor Day. He was not reelected. In 1898, Samuel Gompers, head of the American Federation of Labor, called it, quote, the day for which the toilers in past centuries looked forward, when their rights and their wrongs could be discussed, that the workers of our day may not only lay down their tools of labor for a holiday, but upon which they may touch shoulders in marching phalanx and feel the stronger for it. But according to the Encyclopedia of the American Left, Gompers and the AFL elevated Labor Day as the preferred holiday of the American House of Labor over May Day. Gompers criticized May Day for its ties to anarchist and socialist politics. Well, today we're going to turn first to Howard Zinn. He wrote People's History of the United States. He was speaking this summer in Provincetown on Cape Cod. He talks about Iraq, about labor, and the people's history of the United States. Historian Howard Zinn.
I have great confidence that the truth is beginning to come through to more and more people. This is how change takes place. And, you know, this is how it's a tribute. It's a tribute to the common sense and common decency of the American people that the establishment has to work so hard to keep the truth from us, you see. They, you know, and I really believe that when people learn what is going on, they respond. And we've seen this historically. We've seen this again and again. Now, when the abolitionists, the first abolitionists, the first people in the North who spoke out against slavery in the 1830s began to talk about slavery, they were mobbed and they were attacked, not in the South, all over the North, you know. But the truth that they spoke began to seep through to the American public, the truth about slavery. You know, a man named Theodore Weld wrote a book, Slavery as It Is. And the book, although ignored by the powers that be, was read and read and read, you say. And by the time of the early 1960s, the anti-slavery movement had gone from a tiny handful of people to an enormous national movement. That's why we had an Emancipation Proclamation. That's why we had a 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Not because Abraham Lincoln was elected president, although it wasn't bad, you see. But the key was that when Abraham Lincoln was elected president, this great anti-slavery movement was rising in the country. And we've seen this again and again. We've seen it in recent years when people learn the truth. Racial segregation in the South was really not in the consciousness of the American people. Remember Ralph Ellison's book, Invisible Man? That was true. Black people were invisible, and the condition of black people was invisible. Of course, not to black people, but certainly to the white population of the country. What happened in the 1960s is that black people, seeing that the American government was not going to help them, knowing that the American government, oh, not just the South, but the national government, the government of the United States, had collaborated with the South to maintain racial segregation all through history, black people in the South knew that they had to do it themselves. They had to bring democracy alive themselves. They had to bring the truth to the American people. And so they went out into the streets and they sat in and they went on freedom rides and they demonstrated and they created a commotion in the country which could not be ignored. And people began to learn the truth about what was happening in the South, the truth of what was happening to black people in the South. And then you finally had a national movement that, whether you had a Republican or a Democrat in the House, or if Congress, or in the presidency, it didn't matter. You had a national movement where finally the government had to respond, and you began to see a remarkable change in the South and in the consciousness of the country about racial equality. That's what social movements do. They bring the truth to people, and people, when they learn what is going on, respond. This is what happened during the war in Vietnam. People did not know what was going on in Vietnam. All they knew what was being told to them by the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, and, oh, they fired on our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, who knew where the Gulf of Tonkin was? Maybe it was off the coast of San Francisco, you see. Nobody knew, really. Did the president know? Well, he was briefed. Presidents get briefed. That's how they know about things. People didn't know what was going on. Yeah. And how did they learn? They didn't learn through the major media. They learned through the 1960s equivalents of Democracy Now. They learned through Noam. They learned through books. They learned through independent media like Dispatch News Service, a little group of left journalists who went into Asia, and they were the first ones to break the story of the My Lai massacre to the American public. And when American people began to see what was happening in Vietnam, when finally the pictures began to appear, when finally they saw the huts being burned and the peasants cowering before American power, they began to react to this. And soon we had a national movement against the war. And the war in Vietnam did not end because Henry Kissinger went to Paris. The war in Vietnam did not end because of anything Congress or the President or the Supreme Court did. The war in Vietnam ended because of the people in Vietnam who resisted, and because the people in the United States who finally began to resist the government, and because of the GIs, you know, David, you heard David sing about the San Patricio Battalion of the American GIs who looked around in the Mexican War and saw what was going on and went over to the other side. And in the Vietnam War, it was American GIs who played a very critical role in bringing the war to an end when they refused to go out on patrol, and when they turned against the war, and when they came back, when the GIs came back from Vietnam, and they formed an organization, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. We've never seen anything like it in the history of this country. You know, and they gathered. And some of you may remember that scene where they gathered in Washington, these GIs who had come back from the war, and some of them in wheelchairs or with arms missing, and hurled their medals over a fence into a heap to demonstrate their opposition to the war. The truth began to come out, and the truth had an effect. And I believe that is what is going on today, just the beginning of the truth coming out to the American public of what is going on in Iraq and in the world. Beginning to learn the truth that we are not liberating Iraq, we are occupying Iraq. And during World War II, that expression became well known, Nazi-occupied Europe, Nazi-occupied France. And then after World War II, we talked about the Soviets occupying Hungary and the Soviets occupying Czechoslovakia, you see. And now it's the United States occupying Iraq. And the news is beginning to filter through. I mean, the major media tried their best to bury the news in back pages and to cover it up with all sorts of things, but the news beginning to come through. This is a very ruthless occupation which is taking place in Iraq. They saw, the other day you may have seen this news story about how the U.S. General Sanchez in Baghdad was worried about Iraqi reaction to the occupation. The Iraqi leaders, the ones who were pro-America, were giving him a message, as he put it, quote, "When you take a father in front of his family and put a bag over his head and put him on the ground, you have had a significant adverse effect on his dignity and respect in the eyes of his family." I thought that was very sensitive and perceptive. Amnesty International has been looking into cases of torture in Iraq and beginning to report, you know, case of Raisan al-Abali. His house is invaded by American soldiers. They come in shooting, and they arrest him and his 80-year-old father. His brother is wounded. The three men are taken away, and Khraisan tells Amnesty International later that his American interrogators stripped him naked, kept him awake for more than a week, either standing or on his knees, bound hand and foot with a bag over his head. He said he told his captors, "I don't know what you want. I don't know what you want. I have nothing. I asked them to kill me," says Khraisan. After 8 days, they let him and his father go. U.S. officials did not respond to repeated requests to discuss the case. Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator of Iraq, said, "We are, in fact, carrying out our international obligations." Yes, international obligations, except to the U.N., except to the world. Who is this? To whom? And the soldiers who have to do that, the soldiers are set down in a country which is hostile to them. They become afraid. They become panicky. They become trigger happy. They react with the brutality that fearful soldiers or fearful policemen show when they themselves are afraid. And they're beginning to recognize, and we're hearing the stories about the soldiers who are asking, you know, why are we here? What are we doing here? And an ABC news reporter in Iraq tells him, of a soldier who tells him, I've got my own most wanted list. He was referring to the deck of cards. You remember you reading the deck of cards the U.S. government published, in which they featured Saddam Hussein and his sons and other wanted members of the former Iraqi regime. And the soldier said, I have my own deck of cards. The aces in my deck are Paul Bremer, Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, and Paul Wolfowitz. I think there's something more ominous about than the occupation of Iraq, and that is the occupation of the United States. I don't know if you have the same feeling I do. You wake up in the morning, you read the paper, and you feel that you are in an occupied country, you see. That you feel some alien group has taken over our country. Those Mexican workers who crossed the border to get into California, that is to get into the territory that was taken from Mexico in the Mexican War, you see. And those Mexican workers who come over, and many of them die and are killed in the process, you see, those people are not alien to me, you see. Those 20 million Americans who are not citizens, but who now, because of the Patriot Act, are subject to indefinite detention without any constitutional rights, those people are not alien to me. But those men in the White House who are making these decisions to send young people to kill and be killed, those people are alien to me.
Howard Zinn, speaking this summer in Provincetown on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. We're going to come back to that address. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back with historian Howard Zinn in a minute.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die.
Paul Robeson singing Joe Hill. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman, as we return to historian Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States.
I mean, the country's in the hands of men who care nothing about human life, care nothing about human freedom, care nothing about the earth, the water, the sun, care nothing about the kind of world that our children and grandchildren are going to inherit. And I believe that Americans are more and more, beginning to sense this. The lies are being exposed, and, those... the weapons of mass destruction, it's become absurd, right? What were called the drones of death turn out to be model airplanes. The decontamination trucks turn out to be fire trucks, The mobile germ labs turn out to be trailers making balloons, to say. And so, lies about self-determination. talk about self-determination, and we fly these wealthy Iraqi exiles into Baghdad to take over, just as we flew a ZM into Vietnam back then, and we were for the self-determination of the Vietnamese. We'd flown them in from New Jersey. And then there's a larger lie, you know, that everything that the United States government does here and in the world needs to be done because we are engaged in a war on terrorism, ignoring the fact that war is terrorism, and ignoring the fact that, you know, barging into people's homes, taking away family members, subjecting them to torture, you know, that is terrorism. Invading and bombing other countries does not give us more security against terrorism. It makes us less secure. It makes us more vulnerable. You can get a clue to what the government means by the war on terrorism. If you examine what a Secretary of Defense, if you have the stomach for examining anything said by the Secretary of Defense, but you examine what Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, one of those faces on that sergeant's most wanted list, Rumsfeld said about a year ago, he was addressing the NATO summit in Brussels, and he was explaining the threats to the West. Imagine we're still talking of the West as if it were a holy entity, as if the United States has not alienated most of the Western world and is now wooing Eastern countries and trying to persuade non-Western countries that we want only to liberate them. So Rumsfeld is explaining the threats to the West and why they are invisible and unidentifiable. And he says, I'm quoting him now, because I could not make this up. There are things that we know, and there are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things we now know that we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. These are things we do not know, we do not know. He goes on to say, simply because you do not have evidence that something exists doesn't mean that you have evidence that it doesn't exist. Well, Rumsfeld has clarified things for us. No, really. He's explained why the government, not really knowing where to find the criminals of September 11th, will just go ahead and invade and bomb Afghanistan, killing thousands of people and driving hundreds of thousands of people from their homes, and still not know where the criminals are. You see, it explains why the government, not really knowing what weapons Saddam Hussein is hiding, or if he's hiding any weapons, will invade and bomb Iraq to the horror of the world, killing thousands of civilians and thousands of soldiers and terrorizing the population. And it explains why the government, not knowing who are terrorists and who are not, will put hundreds of people in confinement in Guantanamo and subject them to torture and indefinite detention to the point where suicides have been attempted again and again by the prisoners in Guantanamo. It explains why the government, not knowing who the terrorists are, will put these 20 million people who are not citizens under the jurisdiction of the Patriot Act, depriving them of all their constitutional rights, making them subject momentarily to any kind of invasion of their homes, picking them up, taking them away, and nobody knowing, you know, where they are. So the war on terrorism is not just a war on innocent people in other countries. It's a war on the people of the United States. It's a war on our liberties. It's a war on our standard of living. The wealth of the country is being stolen from the people. Remember what Eisenhower said in that strangely good moment that Eisenhower had when he said that you know, every weapon that is made is a theft from the needs of the American people. The wealth of the American people, the wealth of the people is being stolen from the citizens of the United States, from the people in this country, and handed over to the super rich, and the lives of the young are being stolen. And I believe this is becoming more and more clear to more people in this country. Even the polls, distorted as they are, and they are, you know, even they show declining support for Bush. And I don't know if any of you noticed this, but it's my job to notice these things. It's my job, painful as it is, to read Thomas Friedman, you see. And there was this column that he wrote just after the war began, in which he said, I'm quoting Thomas Friedman, "Don't believe the polls. I've been to nearly 20 states recently, and I found that 95% of the country wants to see Iraq dealt with without a war." This is Friedman, who's for the war, totally, then, now. He also said in his column that his wife opposed the war. She was one of the 95%, you see. It's been interesting to me and important to me because sort of in just from reading American history and from living in the South and being involved in the movement there, to me, I've always thought that you just could learn so much about the country by looking at the history of black people and looking at the attitudes of black people. And all through this period, while the polls were showing majorities in support for Bush, the polls were showing 60% of black people were opposed to the war all the way through. And I had this experience doing a phone interview with a radio station in Washington, D.C., a black radio station called GW on the Hill. GW stands for George Wilson, the guy who was the interviewer on the station. Actually, it was hard for me to say much because all of his questions were rhetorical questions. Like, don't you think that we are in the grip of madness? Not much to say, you see. But after he sort of did this interview with me, there were call-ins. And I took notes, because nobody could see me. I'm home on the telephone. I could secretly take notes on these call-ins. There were 8 call-ins, and all of them clearly African-Americans. And I'm reading from my notes. John, this was right after Colin Powell had given his speech to the UN about weapons of mass destruction. John, what Powell said was political garbage. Another caller, Powell was just playing a game. That's what happens when people get into high office. Robert, if we go to war, innocent people will die for no good reason. Karine, what Powell said was hogwash. War will not be good for this country. Susan, what is so good about being a powerful country? Terry, it's all about oil. Another caller, the last of the 8 callers. The U.S. is in search of an empire, and it will fall, as the Romans did. Remember when Ali fought Foreman? He seemed asleep, but when he woke up, he was ferocious. So will the people wake up. Now, I believe it will become more and more clear that the casualties of war are not just abroad, you know, but here at home. You know, and very often it is said that, you know, that it would be hard to build a movement against the war because we don't have the huge casualties that we had in Vietnam. On the other hand, we have a communication system which, despite the monopolization of the media, has moved faster and more efficiently than any communication system during the Vietnam War. Through Democracy Now, through the community radio, through the internet. And that's why we had those enormous demonstrations against the war, even before the war had started. But I want to say something about casualties, battle casualties. In the Spanish-American War, I always like to go back 100 years, 200 years. In the Spanish-American War, the United States, it was one of those short wars, which we have now become accustomed to. It was called a splendid little war by a member of the cabinet. There were only a few hundred American battle casualties. There were 5,000 soldiers who were in Cuba who died, not battle casualties. They died of poisoned beef sold to the army by the meatpackers of Swift and Armour in Chicago. Every war has its battle casualties and it has its other casualties. What happens to the soldiers who don't die in battle but who die for other reasons? What happened not to the soldiers of Vietnam who died on the battlefield, but what happened to the soldiers afterward? What did they suffer as a result of Agent Orange? How many of the kids were born deformed because of the chemicals that the United States dropped in Vietnam? How many of them began to have psychological problems? How many Vietnam veterans committed suicide in the years? Thousands and thousands of Vietnam veterans committed suicide after the war in Vietnam. And the Gulf War, you know, here too, oh, we've only had a couple of hundred American casualties. The VA, 10 years after the Gulf War, reported that 8,000 veterans of the Gulf War were dead for various reasons. That of the 600,000 soldiers who fought in the Gulf War, 200,000 of them after the Gulf War filed claims with the Veterans Administration for disabilities that they had suffered during the war as a result of the weaponry that the United States was using in the war. The weapons that we use against other people are also used against us. A government that is ruthless about what it does to other people is also ruthless in what it does, you know, to our own people. So what is our job, you know? As Noam said, there's nothing magical, no secrets. I have the same experience he does. People want to know, what is the secret? There's no secret is people. The secret is people getting together. The secret is telling the truth. The truth is powerful, and it can only be suppressed for so long. And the truth gets out, and when the truth gets out, a power is created that is greater than the power of the guns and money that a government possesses, you see. And, I mean, why is it that people all over the world knew things, knew the truth about the American impending war in Iraq and 10 million of them protested on one day, February 15th. Why is it that they knew the truth when the American people still did not? I mean, to me, there's a simple answer. The people in those other countries did not watch Fox News, let's say. So our job, yes, is to tell the truth. And we all can do that. You don't have to be a speaker with a microphone. You don't have to sell hundreds of thousands of books. All of us speak to other people. All of us have neighbors. All of us have people we work with. We have children We are maybe teachers, or we may be librarians, or whatever we do, there are people that we reach. There are ways in which we can communicate information to people and steer them towards sources of information which are different, you know, than the major media. We are all in a position, all of us in a position to do this. And we start with great support. We start with the support of the people of the world. That's great support. And we start with the support of the artists. I've always been struck by the musicians, the actors, the writers, the poets. These are the people who almost always come forward, and through a special sensibility that they have, they see what is right and they see what is wrong. And so our job simply is, in every possible way, in the smallest ways, in the largest ways, in the most apparently innocuous ways, or in the most bold ways, you know, from, you know, writing a letter to the editor of your local paper to doing what those three nuns in Colorado did, civil disobedience, and bringing them years in jail. But all along the spectrum, we all do, you know, what we can do in some way to spread the truth. No action too small, too large for us to engage in, and to defy what the government is trying to get us to do, to keep silent. There are already librarians, and you've maybe read about it, librarians who are shredding their records because they know that the paper, you know, I mean, the truth is, I don't blame the FBI for wanting to see those records. They want to know who is reading Noam Chomsky, you see. But defying them is what more and more people do. I go around the country and I see high school students defying the principal, defying even their classmates, high school students, you see. So that's what social change is about: telling the truth, organizing, acting in every way we can. You know, we live in a beautiful country. It's been taken over, and our job is to take it back. Thank you.
Historian Howard Zinn speaking this summer in Provincetown, Cape Cod, Massachusetts. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. When we come back from our break, a special appearance by Mother Jones on the March of the Mill Children. Stay with us. The Rebel Girl, written by Joe Hill, adapted and sung by Hazel Dickens, today on our Democracy Now! Labor Day special. I'm Amy Goodman. 100 years ago this summer, Labor organizer Mother Jones marched to the summer home of President Teddy Roosevelt on Long Island. By her side were young mill workers. She was protesting the plight of child laborers. Mother Jones' march began in early July, 3 weeks earlier, in Philadelphia, where she'd witnessed 10,000 children working in textile mills for close to no pay. At first, as she tried to come into New York City, the New York police commissioner said she would not be allowed, but relented because of popular outcry. Well, last month, actress Betsy Means chose to commemorate the March of the Mill Children by retracing the steps of Mother Jones. For 3 weeks this past July, she marched, often dressed as Mother Jones, from Philadelphia to New York to Long Island. When officials heard that she wanted to perform, this was Betsy Means as Mother Jones, the Mother Jones address at Roosevelt's summer home in Sagamore Hill, a museum official said, "This is one of those minor footnotes of history," and said she would not be allowed to perform the address at Sagamore Hill, which is now a museum. But neither the march nor the life of Mother Jones can be considered a footnote in American history. The march brought Mother Jones national attention. Within 3 years, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York passed the first child labor laws in the country. At the time of the march, Mother Jones was about 70 years old. Born in Cork, Ireland, the first 50 years of her life were unremarkable except for the fact that she faced tremendous hardship. Her husband and four children all died of yellow fever in 1867. 4 years later, the Chicago Fire of 1871 destroyed her home and store. It was not until she was about 50 years old when she became a full-time union organizer. She would continue to organize and raise hell until her death in 1930 at the age of 100. Well, this summer, Betsy Means joined us in Democracy Now! Studio as Mother Jones.
When I look into the faces of the helpless children and see their appealing eyes, it touches the tender chords of a mother's heart. I stand before you today on behalf of the helpless children. Organized labor and humanity demand protection for these helpless victims of insatiable greed. I have seen your children murdered. Murdered. You are living in America. America, where Patrick Henry and Jefferson live, those heroes of days gone by. The day of child slavery has got to end. On May 29th of this year, in the spring of this year, in Kensington, Pennsylvania, 75,000 textile workers went on strike. Of this number, at least 10,000 were little children. They were striking for shorter hours. They wanted their work week reduced from 60 hours a week to 55 hours a week. Every day at union headquarters, little children came in. Some with their hands off, some with the thumb missing, some with their fingers off at the knuckles. They're stooped little things, round-shouldered and skinny. Many of them were not over 10 years of age, although the law prohibits their working before they are 12 years of age. But the law is poorly enforced. And the mothers of these children often swear falsely as to the ages of their children. In a single block in Kensington, 14 women, the mothers of 21 children, said it was a question of starvation or perjury, that the fathers had been killed or maimed at the mines. I asked the newspaper reporters why they didn't report the facts about child labor in Pennsylvania. Aye, they said they couldn't, because the mill owners had stock in the papers. Ah, is that a fact? But I have stock in these children, I said, and arrange for a little publicity. We assembled a number of girls and boys one morning in Independence Park, and from there we arranged to parade with banners to the courthouse, where I held a great meeting. A great crowd had gathered in the public square in front of City Hall. I put the little boys with their hands off and their fingers crushed and maimed up on the platforms beside me, and I held up their mutilated hands and I showed them to the crowd. Philadelphia's mansions are built on the broken bones and quivering hearts of these children. Their little lives go out to make wealth for others. Neither state nor city officials pay any attention to these wrongs. They do not care that these children are to be the future citizens of our nation. Ah, the city officials were standing in the open windows opposite. I held up the little ones of the mill high above the heads of the crowd and pointed to their puny arms and legs and hollow chests. They're a light to lift. I call upon you millionaire manufacturers to cease your moral murders. And I cried to the city officials in the open windows opposite. Someday, the workers will take possession of your city hall. And when we do, no child will be sacrificed on the altar of profit. Ah, the officials, they quickly closed their windows, just as they had closed their eyes and hearts. The Philadelphia papers and the New York papers quoted my statement about Philadelphia's mansions being built on the broken bones and quivering hearts of children. The Philadelphia papers and the New York papers, they got into a squabble with each other over the question. Universities discussed it. Preachers began talking. That was what I wanted. Public attention on the subject of child labor. Fellow toilers, we have gathered here today for a purpose. Every movement made in the history of civilization has an underlying purpose. You have reached the century in human civilization when the charge of human slavery must forever disappear. I rise to ask the American people, am I my children's keeper? If we could raise up humanity to obviate all strife, what a glorious world this would be. But constituted as it is, society inflicts many hardships on those least able to bear them. We must work for peace and goodwill to all mankind. Children yet unborn, arise and bless you. Take the children out of the mills and mines and sweatshops. Allow them to develop their bodies and minds and souls. These children are to be the future citizens of America. Ah, yes, pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mother Jones, 100 years ago this week, she led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to right here in New York, ending up in Sagamore Hill at Teddy Roosevelt's home in Oyster Bay, though he did not come out to greet them.
Oh, that's right, he didn't.
Can you talk about why you have decided to play Mother Jones? Betsy Means is the actor who is here with us today.
Oh, well, I'll have to break out of character for that now, won't I? I'm going to take off my glasses as a tribute to Mother Jones, and I'll use my regular accent, my Chicago accent. 2 years ago, I found Mother Jones, not just knowing the name of the magazine or that she was associated with labor, and I went back and did research on her, and on a very personal level, I had a deep, profound respect for the courage that she had. She saw tremendous suffering. I mean, how many of us just go, you know, who wants to really, really look at that? I mean, there's so much happening in the world today, and who really wants to take that into their heart and mind and soul? And Mother Jones was able to not only go down into the Georgian cotton mills, into the southern cotton mills, go into these factories that were essentially run by children, look at these children running barefooted up and down the spindles, working day and night in the factory from 6 in the evening till 6 in the morning for 10 cents a night, being just ground out for profit. It's very painful material. And I just respected her tremendously for having the courage to do that.
Can you talk about Mother Jones' history?
Yes, Mother Jones, she was acquainted with grief, as other great teachers that we have known. And she was born in Cork, Ireland. Her grandfather was hanged by the British soldiers. Her father had to flee Ireland. Police came into her home when she was 5, tore down her chimney looking for her father. She saw tremendous suffering in Ireland of the working poor. She came over, her father had come over to the United States. She came over in Memphis.
Tennessee when she was an adult. In 1867, her husband and four children, they were living in the Pinchgut section of Memphis, the poor section, obviously, the hungry section, the Pinchgut section. And a yellow fever epidemic swept through Memphis. And in 1 week, her husband and four children died of yellow fever. Her whole family died. Hmm. And then she went up to Chicago, opened a dressmaking establishment. In 1871, the Great Chicago Fire burnt down everything she had. So then she started going into the burned down churches and listening to these tremendous speakers from the Knights of Labor. The Knights of Labor had been formed just after the Civil War, after chattel slavery had ended, industrial slavery was beginning, or not beginning, but really, really coming into its own as surges of immigrants came over from the old world. And she got radicalized. She got educated. And at this point, she really felt that God had saved her for a purpose. And so she went after that. She had no money. She wore the clothes on her back. She went wherever there was a fight. She did this march when she was 73 years old. She went to Colorado after that, was thrown in prison illegally in her 70s, had guns forced into her face by the Pinkerton boys.
And this was over mining.
This was over mining. Her main work, actually, I chose for my piece to focus on this March of the Mill Children. It was very concise. It was an hour long. But her real work was with the miners of the United States of America. And she went in and these miners were down in the coal mines for 14 hours a day, dying like flies, uneducated, never seeing as she describes gorgeously, the color of the eyes of their children. I mean, they were just being, again, ground out and dying of horrible, you know, hideous diseases. And the mill owners, in the speech she talks about, the mill owners were making 50% to 90% profit out of the mills, and the mine owners were making tremendous profits. So it was really one of these things where greed had taken over, and they were just using these people as merchandise, as chattel, and just grinding them out. If they died, that was fine. There was always another little person to take the place of a child worker when they died.
She also supported Eugene V. Debs, right?
She loved Eugene Debs, absolutely. In fact, when she was down in Atlanta, Georgia, she talked to the miners and railroad boys, and they were the ones that first told her about these little children working in the mills. And she said, you know, it sounded like a modern-day Siberia. She thought that they were overdrawing the picture much, as she put it. And so she decided to go into the cotton mills, and the first thing she was asked by the man who ran the mills is, do you have children? And she lied and said, yes, there's six of us. And he showed her a little shanty to live in. And then she went in Cottondale, Alabama. She went into the mills and saw the children. She was shocked. She was absolutely shocked that this was happening. And then she went over to Tuscaloosa, worked in a rope factory. She walked in, and again, it was run by child labor.
So when did child labor laws get passed in relation to Mother Jones?
That's a great question. This march, the March of the Mill Children that she did from Philadelphia to the door of Oyster Bay, Long Island, in 1903, within 3 years, New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey passed child labor laws that were enforced, underlined 12 times, that no child went into the mills before they were 14 years of age. Federal child labor laws in the United States were not passed until 1938.
Okay, so let's talk about this March of the Mill Children. As she goes from Philadelphia, mm-hmm. with how many kids?
She leaves Philadelphia with 300. I think once they hit the city line, they probably lose half of them. And she had asked the parents if she could have their children for a week or 10 days. Well, the march stretched over 3 weeks. She gets into Trenton, you know, great Union town. You know, they support her. But eventually, there's an attrition rate. These children are very weak. They really can't make the march, even though the conductor on the interurban car gave them free rides for a lot of the way. I mean, basically, it was too hard on the children. So it really dwindled down. So that by the time she marched into New York City, she probably had 30 people with her, men, women, and children.
And what happened in New York?
Oh, in New York, she gets to Hoboken. And she sends a committee over to speak with the chief of police, Epstein, asking for permission to march up Fourth Avenue to Madison Square. Well, the chief of police, you know, forbids their entrance to the city. So she's like, yeah. She goes over and speaks to Mayor Seth Lowe, the mayor's most courteous, but he says he'll have to support the police commissioner. So Mother Jones reminds the mayor that a piece of rotten royalty had come over not but last year, Prince Henry from
You're
Germany.
Listening and to... a Democracy Now! Special on Labor Day. We're talking to Betsy Means, who has played Mother Jones in the March of the Mill Children, the reenactment 100 years later.
She said, you know, these children are the citizens of our nation. They create its wealth. They're not citizens. They don't create its wealth. So finally, the mayor spoke to the chief of police, and they allowed the army in. They allowed the army, and they marched up 4th Avenue, accompanied, she says, by policemen, sergeants, roundsmen, and reserves from three precincts. So, and eventually she holds the meeting in 20th Street, where she shows them. She really, the key thing was showing up with living children, the horrors of child labor. And once she did that to the citizenry, once they got out of these little pockets of mill towns, well, really people didn't know what was going on. And she showed them. The people rallied.
And so she went from New York to
New York.
The home
she
of Teddy Roosevelt.
She went to Coney Island after she had received a letter from. She says the president was from B.F. Barnes, the acting secretary for the president, saying that the president has the heartiest sympathy with every effort to prevent child labor, but it's really the state's issues. And so she continues to march on, and she gets to the door of Teddy Roosevelt's house on July 28th, and B.F. Barnes, the acting secretary for the president, meets her and says, the president needs his rest. I can't be bothered by matters which can be settled by us. If we allowed everyone to see him, he would have no time for himself. So she's like, okay, of course. Well, the president has to go over on safari to Africa. He needs his rest to do that, to go chase the monkeys. And in this speech, and everything I say is Mother Jones's own words, which is Shakespearean, really. She uses, anytime Shakespeare writes a highly emotionalized passage, he uses a lot of repetition, alliteration, assonance, everything. And her speech is just rich with that. It's a very, wonderful verbal horse to ride. But basically, she said, if the Revolutionary Fathers could come back to Earth, the first question they would ask is, what has become of national pride? She said that, Roosevelt had promised everything to labor. When we had our strike in Colorado, she reminds the people she's talking to, he sent 200 guns to blow our brains out. I don't forget, you do, but I don't. Our women were kicked out like dogs at the point of a bayonet. That is America. She goes on to say that some women in this country get up with $5 worth of paint on their faces and have toothbrushes for their dogs and say, oh, that horrible old woman, that horrible Mother Jones. So she said, I am horrible, I admit, and I want to be to you blood-sucking pirates.
Finally, are you going to go to the home of Teddy Roosevelt?
I called Oyster Bay Historical Society. I called Oyster Bay Public Library. I talked to Charles at Sagamore Hill. He'll be hearing that probably. Maybe. No, he probably won't. He might not watch Democracy Now! But anyway, they all said no. I mean, she rips Teddy Roosevelt to shreds. She is furious with him. I mean, this is just not some, hobo off the street. She has gotten substantial press all the way from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, the New York Times. She's been in Philadelphia Inquirer, she's gotten gorgeous publicity. So this is not just anyone coming
Newsday
forth.
Did a very interesting piece, and they called the Sagamore Hill site, and they spoke to the spokesperson, Charles Marcus.
Yes, Charles.
As why you wouldn't be able to perform there on the centennial of Mother Jones's March of the Mill Children. He said, this is one of those minor footnotes of history.
Child labor, child slavery. A minor footnote. It's going on now. What's amazing about this, and what would have really been heroic about Oyster Bay, about Sagamore Hill really bringing Mother Jones in, is first of all they could have had a spokesperson there, somebody saying, what Teddy Roosevelt did do, what he did accomplish. He was involved with a lot of trust busting, a lot of environmental issues, and also it's tragically current history. We're going to the global economy. 33 million jobs were just created in China. They have a horrible human rights abuse record. There's child labor happening all over the world right now, and in the United States of America still.
Betsy Means as Mother Jones. That does it for the show. We want to get a copy, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. From all of us at Democracy Now!, happy Labor Day.